Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the never-retiring, always going to be here, and if he does leave, I will make sure his contract elicits him to come back, Mr. Spencer Williams.
You make one scheduling mistake, and all of a sudden, you're trying to leave.
Exactly, and speaking of not leaving, we have with us intern slash part-timer slash stenographer Amy with us.
Yay, I'm no longer the coffee bringer that brings no coffee.
We've given up on that. We talked to HR, and HR is like, you can't put those type of expectations on the intern, especially when they don't know how to come through. So I was like, you know what, HR, you are right on the money. And speaking of right on the money, we also have some special guests with us tonight, as we are recording with Sacramento's own, from Game Explained, Mr. Joey Ferris. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing good. Is there a Carol in HR?
There is a Carol in HR.
Oh, good.
It's always a Carol.
There's always a Carol.
Carol!
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 We have an exciting show to talk about as we are going to be jumping into Hayao Miyazaki's most recent, because I don't want to call it his last, his most recent film, The Boy and the Heron. So we'll dive into that. But before we do that, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Thursday.
Thursday.
Now on all your favorite streaming platforms and on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got a website. And on that website, we have allegedly over 300 episodes ranging from everything from anime to action to comedy, suspense, rom-com. We even did a little dilly with some holiday movies. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming. And that's Google Play, Libsyn, iTunes, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune in to your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Listen to us there. Give us a follow at The Film Losophers. Give us a follow or subscribe. Listen in. If you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Indeed.
Yes, we have. And if you want to give us your thoughts, you can always drop us a line in the comment section down below. And yeah, I think that's about it. It's kind of a little jumbled all over the place, but yeah. We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode.
You're just having a moment, ain't you?
Yeah, you know, it's always one thing or the other. We are starting the new year off with a banger as we have Joey with us. Joey, this is actually, I believe, your first time here on the show. I don't think we've had you on before.
Not at all.
However, you and I have podcasted before with our parent podcast with Video Game Bang.
Right.
Hosted by Corey, who Corey has been on this show several times. In fact, you are sitting in Corey's chair. Oh, you are using Corey's mic.
Get me out of here then.
Yes. What is it that drew you to wanting to be on the show for today? Because I know we've talked about the Boy and the Heron online, but what is it about you that really stepped out and wanting to talk about this one?
I really wanted to talk about this movie ad nauseum. I've talked about it with my wife, Crystal, several times since seeing it. Like, I think it was a week from today. That was crazy. Like, it's only been a week. It feels like it's been forever.
Yeah.
That's how, when I saw it last. And I just need to process this with a group of film experts, and who better than the Filmlosophers.
And their intern. And
well, speaking of movies, I just really wanted to go around the table. I know that this year we're barely starting out. Things are kicking off, and we are jumping into the year with ultimately talking about one of the best movies from last year. But there are a lot of great movies that are going to be coming out in the year to come in 2024. And I kind of wanted to get your guys' idea. What are some of the movies you guys are looking forward to this year? So let's go ahead and start with Amy's choice here. Yes, because I know you usually have a couple things already under the gun, and yeah, you're always thinking about talking.
Gun, and we're under. Yeah, I do think about talking. Okay.
Remember, we're only doing two each person, so you can't give us all of 2024. Be like, but that's all I'm going to go with. So,
I mean, I could say that and then do that. Inside Out 2 is due for June, and Inside Out 1 kind of grew on me. It wasn't my favorite, but I'm actually really excited to see the plethora of shenanigans it's going to go with puberty. And then the second one. Man, I hate that I have to choose another one.
So Amy likes to do this thing where she says, she goes, oh, I can only pick two. So oh, no, because I really wanted to talk about this one. I want to talk I about did, this one. I want to talk about
another,
this one.
Because there's and another then by one the that's end, coming out from she's, Pixar that I picked one.
She's giving
one
like already
other,
six choices. So, see?
Because there's another one that's coming
so
out.
So, what's
Pixar.
Your second choice? I don't know that movie.
Is that the other Pixar movie?
No. Right.
That's the sequel to the Emoji movie.
No. Oh, nice. Oh, my God. And I just totally blanked on it, and I had it. Do you know what? Screw it. Oh, no. I remember. If.
Okay.
Imaginary Friend. Yeah.
The one with Ryan Reynolds and Steve Carell.
And Big Blue. Yeah. And it's come from John Krasinski, so I'm excited.
Can't go wrong with that. What about you,
going
Joey?
Going from A Quiet Place to that movie.
Exactly. Somebody did something.
So the first one for me is Deadpool 3. Yeah. Very excited very for true. That. Like every time I go back, and I feel like I go back and watch the first two Deadpool movies, and I always find some new joke in there that I completely missed the first, second, and third time.
It's yeah.
Those movies I could watch over and over again, and I'm very excited for this one because, you know, Wolverine's going to be in it. There's like a plethora of other cameos that are being rumored. Yeah. It's just like, and even if this movie does not have like a lot of cameos, I don't care. I watch Deadpool for Deadpool, and that's it.
I think everybody just watches Deadpool for Deadpool.
Right.
So,
yeah,
exactly. And oh, I am so excited for this. My childhood Sonic the Hedgehog 3 in December.
Spencer, yo. You have a watching buddy.
Yes. If the story is anything like Sonic Adventure 2, like just take my money.
I mean, after that banger of a sequel last time, like, let's be honest, that sequel was good. It yes. wasn't even like it was on par, if not almost slightly better, with the fact that they brought in Idris Elba as Knuckles.
Yes,
like that was just a great addition. Now we're going into a whole another realm of Sonic lore in this next one, and it's going to be so incredible. I'm excited for
who
it.
Should play Shadow. Real quick, first name comes to mind: Keanu Reeves. Next,
ooh, that's a good one.
I really, I'm dying for Keanu Reeves.
Yeah,
I would say James McAvoy. Like, I just feel like James McAvoy could embody whatever is needed, and he can add that intensity to it.
I've never heard that suggestion, yeah. And I'm into it.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Ames? Any thoughts?
No, because those are really good. And to be very honest, I'm like, either I mean, you one, could just, I'm not going to be mad
you
at.
Could just go true. With the default everybody's choice Idris and just Elba say Jack Black. Two.
So. I thought you were going to say Chris Pratt, but...
No, oh, God, no. This is Amy's highly anti-Chris Pratt right now, so she's just a little overstimulated with Chris Pratt. Or not, yeah, okay, whatever.
Why is she winding her fist up at me?
Spencer!
Tall chair.
Okay, so Beyond the Spider-Verse, assuming it hasn't been pushed because of the strike last year, super excited about that one.
Okay.
And my second one is Lisa Frankenstein.
Really?
I'm very curious to see what Zelda Williams does.
Zelda Williams, the daughter of one Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. That is going to be an interesting addition to the Frankenstein lore. Yes. It's going to be for it. Yeah, I am super excited because that looks so zany and wonderful and whimsical. You know that there's going to be that Robin Williams charm with a little bit more of like a millennial push in it. And you just know that it's going to be more updated jokes, but it's still going to have that wonderful off-the-cuff humor from Robin Williams.
I have not seen anything about this movie until like before this podcast when I was looking up the 2024 movies. So yeah, I'll have to check it out. It's from the same... Is it like the same director or writer of Jennifer's Body or something?
I think the writer is Jennifer's Body because director Zelda... I think this is her directorial
debut. This is her directorial debut, yeah. Okay. So, but in terms of like the actual writing of it, I'm not too sure who else is behind it.
To the interwebs.
Yes, the interwebs.
To the interwebs.
For myself, I have to go with what I know, and that's horror. And I am super stoked for Robert Eggers' Nosferatu. Mm. That looks so incredible. And... what's his name? Bill Skarsgård is already creepy as all get out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now lovingly. We say that lovingly.
Oh, with all due respect.
Deadpool 2, he wasn't creepy. He was just squished very quickly.
Oh, yeah. He was in Deadpool 2.
Yes, he was.
Forgot about that. But he was also in John Wick 4. So yes. He played the Frenchman.
Right. And
but like, lovingly, he is creepy. And he can play creepy if we've seen anything from the It movies. But to have him actually play... you know, Count Orlok in Nosferatu, and then the clips that are coming out or the pictures that are coming out for like from the scenes with Willem Dafoe as Van Helsing, mm-hmm. or a Van Helsing type character. I'm excited for that. I just really want to see it done, and I want to see it done right. My second one is actually an interesting one because they are going to do a sequel to Twister.
Yes.
What?
Called Twisters. They're wait, taken wait, from really? The Alien yes. format from Alien to Alien, so they're doing Twister to Are Twisters.
We can't get well, all the
you're not
going to
get Bill Paxton, but maybe Helen Hunt might come back.
But we man, most of the Philip people.
I was just gonna say most of the cast isn't
and
here
I love
anymore.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
So I haven't seen a trailer to it, but I love the original movie. For those of you who know me on the show, you know that my family has this big love affair for this film. My mother is absolutely like enthralled with this movie. She loves it to death. I gave her a gift a couple years back for Christmas. It was a Twister themed basket with a steak and a mug and a cow. It, like yes. it was and a Blu-ray copy of Twister. It was totally decked out. She loved it. Yeah. So I'm excited for that. I really hope that that it doesn't fall short of any kind of expectation, because as long as it has Twisters and at least Helen Hunt, I can live with that. I can make do.
I thought I heard somewhere that it's neither a sequel nor a reboot, and I hate it when people say that, because it's like, okay, it's got to be one or the other. Like,
right?
Really. Do you know who's directing it? Because I think I heard it's the director of Minari.
Ooh, really?
Yeah.
I'm looking
okay,
it up.
Okay, so
right
that's in... like, now we really don't know what this movie is. They're like, hey, you know, it could right. have been
but
a
honestly,
sequel, but
like, if I was somebody who directed a film that, like, made it big, that was yeah. just all about, like, oh, it is him?
It's Minari's Lee Isaac Chung.
That's very cool. Yeah, like, I would love to, if I made a movie like that, I would still be like, okay, my next movie, I want to have fun with it. I've never seen Minari, but from what I understand, it's really freaking sad.
Yeah, that's yes. what I've heard, too, as well. So... But, I mean, there's a ton of movies out there, and if you guys have a thought on your own in terms of a movie you're looking forward to, let us know. Drop us a line in the comment section down below, and we'd love to hear your thoughts, because obviously there's a lot of really big surprises coming out for 2024,
and
needless
I didn't
to say...
And I all of them either, that I'm excited, because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's so many.
Oh my gosh, Amy.
I know.
Seriously.
But Joey the third. Joey the third, he should get the third, you know.
Joey, do you have a third choice?
Furiosa.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's gonna be a good one with Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, I hope it's really good. Like, a part of me thinks like maybe Mad Max Fury Road was a lightning in a bottle sort of situation, and you can't replicate that success twice. So I hopefully they can. I mean, it's what been 9 years since the last Mad Max movie.
Wow. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah,
well, where does the time go?
And you take the story of somebody like what's his name, Tom Hardy,
yes.
and him coming into the character and all the things that they originally wanted to do with that role, and they kind of didn't get to do, but it still came out really great, this whole parallel to the Dante's Inferno story. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you still get an opportunity to see something great with that film. This one's going to be different because it's not focused on a particular Max character.
Right.
So they're going to try to explore someone else's like ethos, and let's hope it hits and not misses, but yeah. So, but that about talking about hits, that brings us to our latest part of the conversation, our actual review, our actual take on a movie that we've all been excited to hear, to see. We've all been excited to talk about. And in fact, we've all been excited to finally, you know, consume as a part of the Miyazaki lore. And that is our take on Studio Ghibli's The Boy and the Heron. When it comes to movies, there's really no, you know, replacing someone like Hayao Miyazaki. So the fact that we're getting an opportunity to talk about one in this lifetime, in this decade as of current now, is really a great opportunity. So before I go on any more, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
After losing his mother during the war, young Mahito moves to his family's estate in the countryside. There's a series of mysterious events that lead him to a secluded and ancient tower, home to a mischievous gray heron. When Mahito's new stepmother disappears, he follows the gray heron into the tower and enters a fantastic world shared by the living and the dead. As he embarks on an epic journey with the heron as his guide, Mahito must uncover the secrets of this world and the truths about himself.
Written and directed by Hayao Miyazaki and produced by Studio Ghibli, the film features the English vocal talents of Christian Bale, Dave Bautista, Gemma Chan, Willem Dafoe, Karen Fukuhara, Mark Hamill, Robert Pattinson, and Florence Pugh. A couple pieces of information about the film. This is the first animated film in history to open the Toronto International Film Festival,
yay!
As well as the first Studio Ghibli movie to have the IMAX treatment. Speaking of the film as well, Hayao Miyazaki started working on The Boy and the Heron in 2016 without actually receiving an official green light. So that just tells you how hard the man works, how much he's willing to just put his heart into anything, even if it doesn't have funds. He's like, I got time. I'm going to do all this, this, and that. So another piece of information, the movie's title in Japan, How Do You Live comes from a 1937 children's book by Genzaburo Yoshino. The question is explored throughout the film, which also shows Mahito reading the novel throughout it. So we were talking about it off air a little bit ago, but Amy and Joey were mentioning about the novel and what it's based on. So we'll dive more into that in a little bit. And my last piece of information is kind of the hot button topic about Miyazaki. And, you know, it's essentially asking, will Miyazaki actually ever retire? Nothing is certain with the master behind so many anime gems. Even now, there are new ideas that he talks about. Junichi Nishioka, vice president of Studio Ghibli, told BBC Culture in an interview, he's not physically working on sketches based on these as of yet, but I don't think he will ever be ready to retire. I don't think he's ever going to really let go. He will have a pencil in his hand until the very very day that he dies. End quote.
Yep.
Yep.
Basically.
Can't confirm. That's all of us like, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
You know who else is not retiring anymore? John Williams.
Yeah.
People like these, I just know for a fact, like, people like Miyazaki, they can't live unless they're creating art. And yeah. I am a firm believer in that. He will have a last movie, and we don't know what it's going to be because he's going to die working on it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's...
It's going to be very sad.
Spoil the roundtable question, but we're going to be kind of talking about that towards the tail end of this conversation. But it is one of those things where you look at Miyazaki and you look at the full filmography of what he's worked on over the past several decades, and I don't think there's ever been a miss for the man. In terms of what he's put out, all of his works, everything that he's, you know, we've all grown up with his movies, and the man is still making movies.
I have a confession.
Uh oh.
I've not seen many of his movies.
That's okay.
I know, but I feel like the few I've seen, you know, they're still really good. Like you said, the man doesn't miss. I've only seen My Neighbor Totoro, Spirited Away, Ponyo, this one, Boy and the Heron, and I forgot the other one off the top of my head.
House Moving Castle?
No.
Castle in the Sky?
Actually, I might have just listed everyone that I've seen and thought I had another one after that.
Mind you, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, his filmography spans several
Kiki's
decades.
Kiki's Delivery Service.
There you go.
Yes.
But even though it spans that much time, like, you could watch any of the films and the quality of it never lacks.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter if you watch one that just dropped, like, a week ago, or you saw like, My Neighbor Totoro back in, like, the late 80s. Like, they all are done, like, to the fullest quality. And that's, I think, one of the biggest things that you can always tell when it comes to a property or a piece coming out by Miyazaki is that it's always got that, you know, that quality to it that really surpasses anyone else. Like, he's up there in the echelons of, like, if not the most... like, prolific anime creator ever.
Right.
So let's talk expectations. So diving into this, obviously, we're not going to give away too many spoilers, but we will have to talk about certain aspects of it in order for us to kind of get the idea. But let's be honest, this movie is not about the end. It's about the journey.
Yeah.
So even if you know how it ends, you're still going to want to know how you got from A to Z in this movie. Mm-hmm. So spoiler alert, if you're, you know, sensitive to those types of things, but whatever, that's on you. So let's go ahead and talk about expectations. I want to start with Spence. So we saw the trailers, we saw everything leading up to this. What were you expecting coming into this as a Miyazaki fan?
This movie's gonna be great. And really, that's it. Because, like, again, as we said, this man doesn't really miss. And so, no. Like, he has such a consistent high level quality. I was like, I'm not even worried. Like, I would be shocked if this movie was okay. Like, that's how well he does. So that's what I was going into this movie.
What about you, Joey? What were some of the expectations before you got to the theater? What were you kind of hoping to see, or were you kind of expecting to see from your information that you've gathered prior to seeing it?
I was hoping for a feels trip. And it's interesting because I felt like upon the initial watch, I was like... there were moments where I was just like, oh, the feels, oh, but also I was also like, what's going on? Because it's a very bizarre type of movie. And I didn't, going into it, I had, you know, all the opportunities to catch up on the Miyazaki films I haven't seen yet, but I didn't really want to do that because I felt like I would start comparing.
Yeah.
I would start comparing this to, like, I don't know, Princess Mononoke, his other PG-13 movie. I don't know if he's done any other ones besides those two. And I just wanted to, like, just, like, take it in for what it was.
Yeah.
You know?
There you go. Ames, What were some of your expectations? You being the one who kind of talks about Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki films. In fact, Amy dragged me and Spencer to go see the live action stage production of Spirited Away.
And it was
delightful. And Spencer fell asleep.
The seats were warm.
It was too warm. Too warm.
I get that, though. I understand.
The heaters were on and we were next to... Yeah, no.
We were sitting at the very, very back. So there was like... Yeah.
And it was comfy and toasty. Mm-hmm. My expectations, much akin to Spencer, I was excited. And also much like Joey, I'm going to cry. Yeah, I came into it knowing that whatever I was going to be given was going to be something that one, I hadn't experienced. And two, was going to be moving in such a profound way that I would have to watch it again.
Yeah.
Not out of obligation, but out of desire. So, yeah. What about you, Eddie?
In terms of expectations, so one of the biggest things for me is knowing that Miyazaki's attached to this, there's a level of just quality that, as I've stated already, there's a level of quality that you've come to expect. You don't expect to see, you know, really shoddy drawing. You don't expect to see cells that don't really animate well. You don't expect to see stuttering or you know, staggering kind of cells, staggering kind of animation. You don't expect to see something that looks already done, because it never is. Like, he never does really the same thing twice. Maybe the story wise there's a thread that runs through all of them, but in terms of animation or ideas, there's never two of the same. So when it comes to coming into this movie, honestly, my biggest expectation was I want to see something new. Not that I deserve it, but the fact that I know he won't deliver anything less than something new. And I expect to feel, essentially, that might just be the general consensus, but because of the fact that we were all under the guise that this was going to be his last movie, I expected to feel his last parting gift to the world in this movie. And it's not without saying the fact that everybody who went around wanting to go see this movie was under the impression that this may actually just be his last movie, which drew all of us to go to the theaters and just engorge ourselves with this film and everything that he put in it. But at the same time, I was hoping it wasn't, but if it was going to be his last, I knew I wanted to be in that seat. I was ready to shush multiple babies. I kid you not.
Yep.
I was willing to drop the hammer on whoever. I was willing to give stink eyes, to get up, turn around, flip people off, do whatever I needed. I will shush a child to make sure I hear everything that Miyazaki is trying to tell me. Yeah. And thankfully, I don't think I had to do it in this movie. It's been a couple weeks since we saw it, but... yeah, I think I behaved myself. So let's talk first impressions. So right outside the gate, as soon as we left the theater, what were your first impressions? Let's start with Amy.
I need to see it again immediately. That's literally, I think I walked out and I was like, I just need to see this again right now with less children. Because
don't take your children to see this movie.
No.
It's not a kid's movie.
So that was, brief aside. So went in, theater was packed. Awesome. There were children, not babies. So I was looking at them, I'm like, okay, we're going to try this. But I had crinklers and movers behind me that were like, Mom, what's going on? Mom, what's going on? And then,
there was those in my theater too.
I'm so tired. And I'm just like, oh, I know why Eddie shushes people.
I did shush a child. I do recall. Okay. I'll talk about it.
The desire was there, much, much there. So yeah, I needed to see it immediately with more time for me just to enjoy it. So my first impression was, need see now more. Yes, please.
I gathered what you said. Joey, first impressions right outside the gate. Did you have to shush a child?
No, actually. Okay. Since I saw the movie like 3 weeks after it came out, I saw it in a smaller theater with mostly adults, which were just dead silent throughout the entire thing. Thank you.
Your friends.
Unless they were like laughing, of course, because there's some funny moments in the movie. Man, it's tough to describe my first impressions, because a part of me was just like, because that ending was very abrupt for one. And I was just like, oh, that was it? Oh, that's kind of sad. But But it's one of those movies where the more I talked about it, the more I thought about it. I really don't think I fell in love with this movie until like a day later. It's kind of interesting. Like the more I sat on it and thought about its themes and just thinking like this of course is not going to be his last movie, more than likely, because he said he's working on another one. Rumor has it it's a sequel to Nausicaa, but that's a whole because he mentioned a brief aside, I guess there was a report that Miyazaki, he was starting to sketch something from Nausicaa like for his next project, and he said like, it pains me to return to this world. Like, returning this word fills me with pain. So that's next on my watch list is Nausicaa. But anyway, just thinking like this is, and just the fact that it was kind of an autobiographical piece too. It felt very much like this is an artist like trying to tell me, the viewer, something. Like he was giving a piece of himself in this movie, and I really felt that. I honestly have trouble talking about this movie without crying straight up.
Well, we'll do our best to make you cry. Spencer, what are your first impressions?
So I think pretty much a little bit of both what Amy and Joey said is I need to see this movie again.
Yep.
And I do feel like this movie was talking directly about, like, you know, his own life and, like, basically, you know, this is what's happened so far. Here's what I tried to do. Yeah. And, you know, we're going forward from here.
Like,
this is gonna be... This movie in itself is interesting, and his story is also wildly interesting to me.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. It goes without saying that a lot of his movies are actual pieces of himself imparting like life lessons that he's gone through and things that he's learned and putting it into a film in a very approachable way where not only children can understand, but adults will be able to fall in love with it and just gravitate to it instantaneously. So, was there anything else I didn't want to take from you?
No, I'm good.
Okay, first impression. I'm not going to lie. I cried in this movie because it was just a beautiful just cycle of life that he was putting on display for us to see. And it just goes without saying that this movie is essentially his eulogy for those who are left behind, those that when he leaves this earth, and he talks about it in the movie, and he goes on to say, you know, how, you know, life is just this chaotic mess, and we make of it how we will, and the people who work too hard to try to keep things, you know, in some kind of order are just going to be more tossed in the chaos altogether. I mean, he essentially stated that he himself is a man of chaos and he enjoys living like that, and how he went into it is how he's going to go out with it. And I just watching this movie, it creates this like inner dialogue within yourself to ask yourself, like, it ultimately makes you question your own journey, you know, and makes you wonder, like, how have I been living this life, and am I more focused on the structure or the chaos? And to each his own in terms of how they live and whatnot. But you could just take this movie in itself, and if you just took the script and you put it on a stone, it would make for a perfect eulogy to someone out there who lived their life to the fullest. And I feel like he is showing us that he is at the door. He may not be walking through it just yet, but this is his doorknob for us to read and see that this is where the door leads. And once he walks through it, this will be the final reminder of who he was. And mind you, there's a lot going on with that. But you take with it what you will. And it's such a great movie in itself, outside of the more darker and more somewhat sinister undertones of the film in certain aspects. It's still a movie that is fun and interesting, and there's a lot of great parts, like Joey mentioned, that are funny, that have humor behind it. There's a lot of parts that get really dark really fast. I mean, like, I've never...
So much blood.
Oh, my God. So much blood. Like, I've never ever wanted to look at another heron and hear... Willem Dafoe's voice about killing him. I'm like, that's something that's going to stay with me for
a
while.
That was a pelican.
It was a pelican? Okay.
Willem Dafoe was the pelican.
Well, either way.
We also needed to preface that I saw English dub. Joey, what about you?
English dub.
Spencer, English dub?
English dub.
Okay, so we appreciate and understand the talents of the Japanese voice cast. We will see this with your guys' language, but right now we're reviewing the Americans. Yeah. Or not, well, the English speakers.
As I stated, the English vocal cast. I said that
earlier. I don't know.
Let's talk about... So, speaking of Willem Dafoe, let's talk about the performers. And in this movie, there are a ton of great performers that just really do just excel as part of this ensemble cast. Let's just really quick, right off the bat, the return of Christian Bale.
Yay.
In a Miyazaki film. By far one of the biggest surprises for me. And in this one, he doesn't change his voice for the American accent like he did in Howl's Moving Castle. Mm-hmm. So in this one, he plays the father, which was a great turn for him. It wasn't a very, very in-depth character. Didn't have a lot of screen time, but for the parts that it was, I believe like one of my favorite parts was him screaming about how they turned his boy into a budgie. Which is a great scene to hear Christian Bale in his English accent say. He was a stand-up for me. But I want to throw it over to Ames. Was there anybody who was a stand-up for you? I want to give everybody an opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm going to wait till somebody else brings it up. But the other one, like the big one. But I want to talk about Dave Bautista as the parakeet king.
Oh,
it was
right.
Just Dave Bautista as Dave Bautista as a bird.
Yeah.
With a crown.
Perfectly cast.
Perfectly cast.
Mind
was,
you.
Again, another small one. Like another not that big of a part, but it was well done.
I mean, but if you're Dave Bautista and Hayao Miyazaki is asking you to voice one of his characters, who was it that Kate Blanchett who told Guillermo del Toro, she goes, I don't care if I'm a pencil in your movies. I want to be I want to do a voice in your next movie. And she ended up being the Sphinx in the Pinocchio film. But she told the press, she goes, I told him, I said, I don't care what I have to do. I will voice a pencil in your movie. And I'm like, I'm thinking that's the exact same mindset. Like if Dave Bautista was approached and said, hey, so Hayao Miyazaki is going to do his last movie. He wants you to voice this character. Now, it's only on for like about 30s. I'm in. Like easily the easiest yes you could ever think of,
right?
Like and let's not water that down with the incredible like uptick on Dave Bautista's capability as an mm-hmm. actor. I mean everything that we've seen him in from when he started in smaller pieces like the Riddick movie that he did at one point in time. He did a lot of little like big guy kind of things, and then he moved to like the more subtle things. Like he did the one of the replicants in Blade Runner 2049.
Yes.
He was in Dune. He was in the Knock at the Cabin. Glass Onion. Like all movies that require a lot
and
more
Guardians
nuance.
Of the Galaxy, which was...
Of course. I apologize. Of course.
We glance over it, but let us not... We understand exactly. Dave Bautista has comedic props and chops and all that jam. But seeing him in the Knock at the Cabin, I think was like a turn for me to see how drastically he pivoted from just being like, I'm a lighthearted dum-dum to like, I'm an actual menace, I'm a thoughtful menace. And I'm like, oh.
Well, yeah, it was
delight and scare me.
Because it was part of that moment where Denis Villeneuve was like, you know, I know you can do better. I know you can do great. And gave him that role in Blade Runner. And then you transition over to someone like M. Night Shyamalan, who's like, I saw your role in that movie. I want to give you a chance in this movie. And he nailed it at Knock at the Cabin. I've read the book and I have seen the movie. And I highly recommend the movie over the book multiple times over.
That's all right.
The book is just a little I in terms of his performance, maybe not the whole movie, but in terms of Dave Bautista seeing him embody that character, I think he's great in that one. Any other individuals that are you want to highlight? Start go ahead and head over to Joey.
I want to highlight three because they all played like very small like pudgies in this movie and they had a few lines, but I thought it was so funny.
Oh really?
Dan Stevens was a parakeet.
Yes, it was. Ah.
So was Tony Revolori, whatever his last name is. He was Flash in the
Flash Thompson
in the new Spider-Man movies. And I don't know how to pronounce this man's name. It's Mamoudou Athi. He was in what was that Pixar movie? Elemental.
Yeah, he's Wade Ripple.
Yes. It's so funny because his one line is him crying, it's like, it's so beautiful. And I'm like, that's literally you from that movie. I recognized that voice immediately because that movie's on all the time at my house. I have a toddler. So
good choice.
Yeah, it was fun hearing those.
I didn't know he was in this movie. Yeah. Wow.
For one, Dan Stevens and Tony Ravioli are like really easy to miss.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, I guess that was like a lesser case of Dave Bautista, where it's just like, if you want to be in a Miyazaki movie, but you only have three lines, you're going to take it.
Exactly.
You're going to take it.
Without a doubt. Like, if you're going to be etched in the legacy of Hayao Miyazaki as a parakeet, you're going to be a dang parakeet. Like, yes. That's what you're going to do.
The cutest parakeet.
Yeah. That's really cool. I didn't know that those three were in it. More specifically, that actor, we're going to have to figure out his name, Mamoru Athi. Yeah.
Yes.
Spencer, was there anybody you wanted to highlight?
Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
Because that man has just had a long history of voice talent, and he is phenomenal.
He does not miss.
Speaking of returning to a Miyazaki film, because he was one of the bad guys in Laputa, or Castle in the Sky, and having him in this one as another type of character, because he plays essentially the main bad guy in Laputa. Mm-hmm. And so seeing him as this kind of...
Muska, that's his name.
Sorry. Yes. Oh, Muska in Laputa.
Sorry, my brain's like, he had a weird name, and Jim Cummings called him by his name, and his name was Muska.
Muska. Like, oh, yeah, that's right, because he's the general. sorry. Yeah, Mark Hamill is so great. Having Mark Hamill just still doing things right now, not to say that he's on his way out or anything, but to say that, you know, just to know that he's still working in the business is a really big, like, comfort to me. I'm just going to say that right now. Like, I would hope that Mark Hamill never, ever, ever... Well, I take that back.
Forever?
That he never stops doing vocal work, but I know he's no longer going to be doing the Joker. He's already stated that he retired his opportunities to do the Joker because of...
His Batman.
Yeah, his Batman, Kevin Conroy.
Rest in peace.
Rippy, baby.
But the fact that he is still doing parts and he's still continuing to etch his legacy with that of Miyazaki. Let's see.
I got more if I'm allowed.
Well, I wanted to bring in a couple, like two of mine before you go nuts with it.
They're probably the same ones.
Probably, but my biggest one is, and the biggest surprise for me is Robert Pattinson as the gray hair.
Yeah. We were all going to talk about it.
Like, we were waiting. We're just wait. Yes.
I don't know where this man pulled it out of, but he pulled out
Twilight Rage somewhere.
No. It was a combination of Twilight Rage and the broodiness of the Batman, and you smack them together, and you have and all the things he had to go through in the lighthouse. So just
we don't even bring up his brief, like, you know, Harry Potter. You're there, you're adorable.
He died.
That could be he like walked in and out in like 4 days.
He walked in. He was smiley. He was nice. He died.
He dropped out of a tree and then he drops dead by the end of the movie. I mean, it's like it is what it is.
Cyclical.
But Robert Pattinson. You wouldn't know who Robert Pattinson is in this movie until you see the credits, because his voice is so masked and changed for the role of the Grey Heron that it is absolutely... I almost thought it could have been either Willem Dafoe, Mark Hamill.
Dude sounded like the Joker.
Yeah, he did.
Plays Batman and the Joker. Let's just say that. This movie has two Batmans and a Joker in it.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. Watch DC after this. It's like, hey, Robert.
I was trying so hard to like... Because sometimes when an actor puts on a voice for something, you can occasionally hear like little bits of them through. Not once.
No.
I couldn't hear his natural voice in there at all.
It was the most shocking thing in this movie.
Without a doubt.
Like, we could pick up Christian Bale because I was like, oh, there's the tick. Like, well, you heard it.
Because he never changes his vocal style. He is just English. And that's what he is in this movie. And it's like everyone else, there's like Willem Dafoe, it's just iconic. You know it's him when he's doing it.
But it took us even getting to the point where you actually got to Willem Dafoe, where like, that's Willem Dafoe.
Yeah.
Because the entire time when I was listening, I was like, that sounds like Willem Dafoe. Is Willem Dafoe the Heron? And I made sure that I did not look at the cast list like beforehand because I wanted to at least be like surprised.
Yeah.
And this was, I was floored. Like all the clapping, all the like the finger snaps. This is one of my favorite vocal performances of the year.
Yeah, it's crazy how Robert Pattinson changed his voice so much that it sounded exactly what I would think the character looked like in the movie. Like, it was like they gave him a picture, like, we need you to do this voice. And he goes, okay. And then he does it. Like, because he was like, he was super broody and low vocals in the Batman, like, I know what you did. And then it's like, and then he does the same thing similarly in Twilight. So it's like, okay, you know that he's capable of doing the low, but this was just straight up like, Goblin, like Green Goblin, Willem Dafoe.
He got the mind goblin.
Exactly. It was just like I have to tip my hat to Robert Pattinson. Whatever he is doing, I'm loving this. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. just age of his career. Everything that he's done within the last 10 years has been phenomenal. Yes. And that is saying a lot for somebody who pretty much wrote him off because of all the Twilight movies. Right. Like, yeah. I was like, after he left Twilight and then after he left Kristen Stewart, I say he got better.
apparently, before this, before he got was cast in the movie, he like recorded, it was, the voice was his idea. And he recorded on like his iPhone and like sent it to the casting directors. Mm. And they were like, okay, come on in then. Yeah. Right. So it's really cool. A part of me was just like, okay, if it doesn't sound like Robert Pattinson, why not just hire a real voice actor?
Yeah.
That's like part of my, I also just know a lot of voice actors like personally. And I know like the celebrity and voice actor thing is kind of irritating in the animated film industry, but I'm still just kind of like, I mean, it's cool. It's awesome that he put on that voice. And you go back and look at his like film, like the films he's done after Twilight, he puts on a different voice for like just about everything. Mm-hmm. You hear him in Good Time, especially where he puts on like a New York accent. He does almost unrecognizable.
Yeah. Honestly. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. He has become probably one of my favorite actors in this last 10 years of all of his work. Like, he has just shown up and showed out. Like, he's mm-hmm. really done something different. So I'm actually really excited to see what else he has in store, especially with the new Batman.
Maybe he'll play Shadow the Hedgehog.
There you go.
That would be a complete surprise, and no one would see that coming.
Right. This was his first voice acting role, too. Fun fact.
Oh, ooh. Really?
Yeah, first ever.
Oh, wow.
First ever.
Dang. Voice acting.
I know. Yeah. So. I'm like, ADR doesn't count, I guess.
No.
Sorry. Really.
Let's talk about the story.
I had one more.
Oh, you had one more?
Yeah. So I wanted to bring up Florence. It's Pugh, right?
Pugh. It's just Pugh. Like, pew, pew.
I like that better than, yeah. As Kiriko. So she does the voice across the board. So she's the little old lady that's like got the Jones in for the cigarettes. And then when she is like young her with the Wada Wada, it was so delightful to hear her do that flex too. And her character was actually somebody that I was like, okay, she's kind of cool. I like you too. You're really awesome.
Yeah, so. I heard her as the old lady and I didn't really, I was just like, wait a minute. Is she playing two characters in this? Well, then I realized it was one character.
Later on,
and I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, there was my second one. Sorry. Yay!
Let's talk about story. Let's talk about what we got out of this. So a lot of the story, as we stated, we already mentioned in the synopsis, essentially it's taking place towards the tail end of World War II, which seems to be the framework for a lot of, or the background for a lot of Miyazaki films. It's around that era, if not affected by, or right before, it's affected by this war, which is a very important part of Hayao Miyazaki's life, because this is when he was a young boy. He lived through a lot of this, and that's how he puts it into his art. But let's talk about in terms of what we got out of that story for this film. I want to start with Joey, because I know, Joey, you've been wanting to really chat about this and talk about this. What did this story mean to you specifically for this film?
There's a lot in this story, like not just about grief, about like parenthood too. I think just in general, ever since becoming a parent, a lot of media just hits me way harder now, even if it's not exactly about like parents in general. Like, yeah, it's a part of the theme, but like you were saying earlier, a lot of it, the main theme is basically just about, hey, life is chaos, and it's about what you do with this gift of life that really determines like who you are, stuff like that. I feel like Mewtwo said that in the Pokemon movie.
Yeah, but we got it differently there.
Yeah, and it's as someone who like I don't deal very well with disappointments or like things just getting in the way of life. Of course, I've never gone through anything nearly as bad as the main character has gone through, but like he's given a choice. Do I just continue living in the real world, or can I stay here and control it? Kind of minor spoilers, but like I said, this is not about the story, it's about the journey. And in the end, he chooses, like, I don't need to control any of this. I need to go back and live. Like, I lost my mom, but I have somebody who wants to be my new mother. And yeah, it was just really powerful. And that, you know, my wife, who's also a mom, that element of the story hit her really hard too. Yeah. And just seeing this poor young kid like going through like the worst thing a child can go through, and like him like physically harming his own self. It's just like this movie is so, it's for one not a kid's movie,
like no. 100%,
it's really not, but it's so, it's, I'd say it, it's deep. This shit's deep. And, yeah. And I really just appreciate it for that. And yeah.
And I think that's kind of the dichotomy of this story, in how there's a literal story that's happening, and then there's like a emotional, almost on a spiritual sense, kind of a story.
I'm gonna tell you right now, I don't pay attention to the literal story like at all when I think about this movie. Like yeah. I think a lot more about like not exactly what it's saying, but like how it's saying it.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
No, and it's true, because like you take a lot of the elements from this story, and you can just see the parallels. Like it's like Miyazaki is just screaming out what he really wants to say through the speakers of the characters in this story. Mm-hmm. Like the ideas, the ideology, the goodbyes essentially, and the makeups of creation and, you know, destruction, and all of how that works hand in hand. He's got such I hate to use the term, but it's almost like a biblical sense of how he's creating his final, well, to our thoughts, his final masterpiece, for us to understand the beginning and end of how he sees life, and how he sees it through the lens of somebody who just chooses to be chaotic all day, mm-hmm. who wants to be somebody who isn't like who he was before, but wants to remember that, but also wants to look forward to the future, but doesn't want to fixate on that. And it's like that chaotic balance of the world, and realizing that the only way you can live is if you throw both of that to the wind and just push forward. And that's pretty much how he says it in this movie. And with all the little elements that come into play with all of it, you can't help but just be moved by the fact that this man is saying goodbye in a movie to millions and millions of people who love him. Like, there's yeah. no doubt that everybody at this table here absolutely love not only his creation, but the man himself, the creator himself, the things that he has done. He is ultimately a storyteller for us. He's been a storyteller for us for the last like 4 decades. He has given us tale after tale. He's given us comfort. He has given us joy. He has given us, you know, these opportunities to learn about bravery and courage. And in those same efforts, learn about how to experience grief, and how to process loss, and how to see the world for what it is, this continuous chaotic machine that will continue to churn things out. As long as you stay steadfast in who you are, the world will continue to turn, but you will never change.
Yeah.
And that's how he just wants us to, that's how I took this movie, that even with Mahito going in and doing everything and having, like Joey said, that almost chaotic decision to make of whether to stay and try to make the pieces work and try to keep the world as structured as possible, or to just know that he needs to move on and he needs to let go, but remember, and just there's so much, like you could literally sit in like a college like classroom and just, you know, dissect this to the fullest. But
yeah.
Ames, what about you? Because you're a mom. You have children, and just like Joey, like the expectation for a lot of people when they see this movie is going to be more of the, you know, perspective of the young boy and everything that he's gone through. As a mom, how do you feel coming out of this film?
Well, it's kind of a bit of both when I talk about the different themes that were coming out of this. One is a mom, the heartbreak of the opening sequence is just, it's gut-wrenching. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, much like when we find out that the girl's mother is sick and in the hospital in My Neighbor Totoro, like right at the beginning, where you're like, oh, this mm-hmm. is gonna be bad. This really, like, it just rips you apart in such a way that the one thing that you hope for when you become a parent is to protect them from things like this. And you never think as a parent that it's going to be you. Hmm. And in that way, and then the reintroduction also of Mahito finding his mother later on in the younger version that we see, and her confidence and understanding and her peace without knowing how she goes out, but how she goes out, it provides him peace, which is something that a lot of parents don't get the opportunity to say to their children. For me, not only being a parent, but looking at this from Mahito's perspective, it was the trauma of grief that really resonated with me, not in just everybody in the world moving around him, moving on. And he's sitting in that space, and he's not only ruminating on it, it is seeping into every crack of who he is. And it's his temperament, like everything. You see what was lost in the opening sequence. And then moving through the story, you continue to see what he has chosen to, and how he remains trying to move forward, but not really. He's a stick in the mud in that. And
well, and in the, not to cut you off, but even in the way he chooses to process, you know, the stoic nature of Mahito as the second man in the house, and him just pushing forward.
He has to take care of everybody, and there is the innocence was truly lost. And when we get to the tower and everything that therein entails, one of my favorite writers, her name is Erin Morgenstern. Her sophomore book was called The Starless Sea. And this world really echoed that space. Mm-hmm. That book encompasses that there's a library, like almost in the middle plains, and it is an all-inclusive library, and it has everything you could ever read, but only certain people can find it. And the person that controls it is more of a keeper than a creator. But the world is just as chaotic. Everything flows together. And you're looking for a sea, but there's technically no real sea, but there's pirates. Like, it's a great book. If you get the opportunity, her first book, The Night Circus, is one of my favorites. But this one, it matched in tone and intentionality. So when we get to the tower and all of the chaos and the fantasy that's living inside of it, and Mahito has to make that choice.
Yeah.
When he's just like trying to figure out what's going on, but he's continually drawn to giving into his grief.
Yeah.
And you're watching time and time again, the world around him as he interacts with it is screaming to just to let himself get lost. And people keep showing up to pull him out.
Yeah.
We see it at the gates with Kiriko. We see it with the Warawara and the Pelicans. We see it with the Budgies. We see it with, like, you see it and see it and see it and see it and see it. And part of you is going like, how easy would it be for him to just give in? Which you see moments that Miyazaki has animated where it looks like he's just ready to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes somebody else coming in and pulling him out to give him the push.
It ultimately takes the strength of his mother to come in and pull him out, which there's just so many, like,
there's layers upon layers
in this movie.
Yeah. I'm just thinking also about how like everyone, it seems like everyone else has moved on, but it's just like, if you really think about it, everyone's still having trouble moving on. Like his dad just decided to get with his sister-in-law straight up.
Exactly.
Part of me is just like, okay, that's messed up, really. But also, it's just like,
all of us are like, dude, and you're pregnant now. And she's like, everything's going to be okay. And even he's like, mm-mm. And we're like, we're with you, bro. 100%. Too fast.
Right? But in the way, that was also his dad grieving too, because just like this, he's trying to find a replacement for his dead wife. And who else but his sister, who also... or like her sister, who also looks like her.
Yeah.
And like, she's grieving too. She's grieving so hard. She wants to take care of like her sister's son and like also be his new mother. And she's going through, she can barely even get out of bed. Like she said, they say it's like pregnancy sickness, morning sickness, whatnot, but it's grief. It's big time grief and depression. Yeah. And it's just fascinating. There's so many layers to it.
Yeah. And when we get to towards the end, when we talk about the theme of grief, you can see how it resolves. But again, like we're talking about, it's not just grief. It's not just this. There's like Eddie, you said it right. This is we could have an entire semester of class on just this movie.
Without a doubt.
What about you, Spence?
Well, I suppose the thing that stuck out to most of me was the ending and how like, it kind of slowly transformed from, like, you know, this, especially when Mark Hamill's granduncle shows up, how it kind of transformed from being about the story to be about Miyazaki himself in, like, his own attempts to, like, you know, continue his own legacy.
Yeah.
And then it kind of just is like, you know, I've gone this far and no one has picked up. There is no successor. Everything will now fall apart.
Yeah. Which like if ever there was a bleak moment, it was like, oh shoot, we all got to learn how to draw quick.
And wildly, I was also like, if there's not too many people who can say something like that, and I wouldn't be like, you have such a big ego. But with him, I was like, no, you're 100% correct.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like 100% I'm on your side. Like it's just going to be real bad after that.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Like, it is one of those moments where you know, I think Guillermo del Toro said it best. He goes, we are in an age to watch Mozart compose. We are watching him create art. Once he's gone, there's no more Mozart. Mm. There's no more Miyazaki. There is no one that will ever be like him ever again in the history of history. And the fact that, I don't know if it's due to maybe the way he has his work schedule or the lack of people wanting to learn in the vicinity, but I do hope that there is going to be a carrying of that legacy. But if it seems like what he's trying to put down, he's like, well, y'all don't want to do anything, so when I drop the mic, I drop the mic and y'all are done with this concert.
Well, it's also Studio Ghibli was sold to Nippon TV. Mm-hmm. So they're... He's, you know, the co-founder, and between that and then Goro, and I know Spencer and I were talking about it, Goro has not seen critical success even with the Miyazaki name, and at times they have established that mm-hmm. not only is that a strained relationship, but Miyazaki has come back, like Tales of Earthsea was the first one that Goro put out, and he said yep. it was a good film, but he should stop making films. And when your dad tells you that,
bro.
you're like, oh no. And no. then you had Up on Poppy Hill, which was another Goro, which didn't do bad, but it wasn't really pulling the heartstrings. And then Spencer reminded me that it was Hedwig and the
Earwig and the Witch.
Earwig, yeah, which which tragic. The design was great, but CGI not so
nope.
much. Nope. And Miyazaki proper comes back and he's like, "Hey, this was beautiful," and he had helped with like some concept sketches. So I'm like, "So nobody wants this," and you're just like, "I guess that's where we're at." Like, my soul.
I want to talk about, since we're on the topic of you know, specific scenes and whatnot, I want to talk about if there's any highlights or issues that you guys really want to isolate. If I know there's probably no issues, but you know, there's always someone. And so, I want to kind of go around the table really quick. If you can give me your highlight or issue, if you have one.
I've got a highlight.
Okay, yeah, Spencer.
Art. Like, this is like just going through, like, there's things from here that are like, I get vibes of other movies,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, he's never done that before, but I really like it here, because this is kind of like, you know, well, it was his like farewell tour.
Yeah.
So like, I kind of get because I remember there was something from specifically like Spirited Away where at the family house, and I'm like, I feel like this would fit in the background of a scene from that movie. Mm-hmm. So I'm like just a lot of the art from this movie is glorious.
Yeah. Without a doubt. Joey.
The whole dang soundtrack. You thought I was going to say movie, right? I said soundtrack.
Yes.
How do you pronounce his last
name? Hisaishi.
Yeah. So he does pretty much every Miyazaki film.
He's right? The John Williams.
Yeah, Miyazaki.
Yeah.
He's doing a live tour right now, so I'm trying to get tickets.
He's
anyway.
Coming to America.
Yeah. And it's just, this was kind of like my real introduction to his work because, like, yeah, I've only seen like a few Miyazaki films, but this is like the first time I really like heard the soundtrack to it. And it's just like there's moments in this movie where like everything else just feels like just completely quiet, but you hear like do some piano in there.
Yeah.
But of course, like the song that plays when he's reading How Do You Live, one of my favorite ones. I forget what that one's called. But then there's The Great Collapse, my favorite one. If you haven't seen the movie, you've definitely heard it in the trailer for, I think, the English dub. Just fantastic, dreamlike score there. And it's... he's probably not going to get nominated for best like original score.
He better,
right? Like, but I don't trust the Academy.
Yeah. Very true. And for those of us here who have listened to a lot of the other soundtracks, this one is absolutely distinctly different. Mm-hmm. Like you can catch on like the little subtleties, but overall it is unique to the max. Mm-hmm. Like, this That's is different cool. than the soundtrack to Spirited Away. Spirited
or
Away
Ponyo,
is
or Ponyo
or Howl's like, or Laputa or Totoro, like, or Princess Mononoke.
Just
all yeah. different.
It's everything.
They're all different. So
so cool.
It is really cool. Once you start getting into a lot more of those soundtracks, I'd love to hear your thoughts on all
for
of
sure.
Amy.
Well, I think they kind of summed everything up. So I would love to talk about moments, but it's all art, so we're screwed. Everything's great.
It's this true.
Is terrible. Everything's brilliant. If I was going to pick one moment that really stood out to me as just like, this is going to become like the quintessential, there's something from most of the movies that's like, oh, it's the baby Totoros from Totoro, or it's the soot sprites. It's the Wada Wada.
Yes.
Like, even the entire sequence, which I will not spoil it for you, these guys, there's some of them that got butts. There's some of them that got muscular calves and arms. Some of them look like little chubby, extra happy adipose. Like, come
for the Doctor Who
come
fans
with
out there.
You. Come with you. These are.
And these are the Korok looking guys, right?
They exactly.
Yeah, okay, thought so. They're based on real, like, Japanese mythical creatures. I forget what they're called.
And then, yes. And you'll see them when you do Princess Mononoke.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Those, and I can never pronounce their name, but they're like little bobbleheads. Yeah, literally, same thing. It was, for me, I'm like, these guys are so derpy, so cool. They're going to be like the new incoming soot sprite. So that was really great to see, like, that moment show up. And again, everything, if there's one moment that really I can just go, it's one of my favorite. It's that opening sequence. Not only is it heartbreaking, yeah. but the animation style goes from being very, very line driven and composed to him running through the streets and everything is fluid and moving. And it feels like you're being not only driven through a tunnel, but everything is pressing in on you, and there's so much movement and life in this animation that I can honestly say it does not compare to anything else I've seen from Miyazaki. And literally, this man has been animating for over 5 decades.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to be able to go, holy crap, I never seen this before, like ever, and to still feel connected, to understand, to see.
Yeah. I think
it's art. It's art. Anytime and there's music.
Anytime the animation increased frames, I was like glued to that screen.
Yep. Yeah.
There were times Absolutely. Where it's just like, there's just a lot of like moments where things were getting all clustered. All those pelicans in that one scene.
Yes.
I don't animate at all, but I know watching those scenes, I'm like, this was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I know this was a nightmare.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. And like with the scene in the delivery room with
the paper.
With the paper.
Yeah.
That's
oh, yeah.
going to stick with me for the rest of my life. Like Seriously. This whole movie will, but yeah. that scene especially.
I think that's my absolute highlight is the just higher level of animation that this film has for an anime, for a hand-drawn, mostly hand-drawn, very minimal CG film that really is encapsulating a classic story, a story of old tradition. This is a phenomenal film. This animation style is beyond anything that anybody could probably do. I would easily say that this animation style I think is better than that they've been doing with the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse animation. Like it's up there in terms of the unmatchable quality that they put out every time they put a movie out.
I think it's because when you quoted Guillermo, he's 100% right. Mm-hmm. We're watching Mozart. We are actively participating in engaging in his art, and there will be nothing else. Like once he's gone, flipping, like, we're all going to cry. But literally, it's once he's gone, there is no more Mozart for us. And we'll have to wait. And hopefully, we'll have the opportunity to experience someone with some level of skill. But
we will.
He's a master.
Exactly. He is a master. But I don't get upset when, like, big art. Of course, I get upset when they die. But I also don't think, like, oh, like the world's like just we're never going to see art this good again. It's just like we'll never see that particular art again.
Yeah.
But there's going to be other artists that are going to put out like equally amazing work, but not in the same way, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
'Cause it's their voices that matter. This is like his work, Miyazaki's work is his voice, and his voice will always be just his own. But if you're trying to get someone to emulate that's not going to work. It's never going to work. 100%. So, yeah, we're all getting in the weeds like, yeah, we're going to be so sad when he dies. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, well, people die.
Well, speaking of which, that brings me to the roundtable question.
Are people dying?
Both. So we all know that Miyazaki is already brainstorming the next project, but is that exactly a good thing? What would you feel is the worst outcome? That Miyazaki finishes the project that he's working on now, but it's not as good, or he isn't able to finish it, and what we have currently that is available is a masterpiece.
I have one caveat on that. It's he passes away, the part that he completes, it's not completed, it's a masterpiece, and somebody tries to finish it. If somebody tries to finish it, that's a hard no for me. I would rather take
what he has left.
What is left, what he gave, and be able to watch that and celebrate that and go, this was it, versus like if he
him being pushed and rushed, or rushing himself. Essentially, he's only doing it to himself, but rushing himself. Yeah. And yeah. How do you feel, Joy?
Yeah, you know, I guess another guy finished Mozart's Requiem. Like, he died in the middle of his final composition. That's right. And somebody, my wife just told me this too. And it was just like, oh, but people still love Mozart's Requiem. So I feel like that situation, like if he dies in the middle of a project and someone else take the reins to finish it, I feel like that could work as long as they have like a plan ahead of time.
Yeah.
Right. Like they have like a game plan of just like this, these pieces need to go here. If I don't make it, whatever. Stuff like that. I feel like that's like I wouldn't say the best outcome is he lives to finish his final movie.
That is the hopeful mindset here. But just in playing devil's advocate, obviously we have to look at all sides of the coin and make sure, you know, we discuss all sides. In the best outcome, yes, that he finishes his last piece, if it's his last one, and it is as absolutely beautiful as we all know it will be. On the flip side, the question.
Yeah, so. the worst outcome is like, I don't even want to say like he works on it and it's not that great, because I don't think that's humanly never a possible. Possibility. Yeah, that's not possible. Yeah. He's whatever he makes, it's gonna be good. Like, and I feel like I gotta agree. If he works on it and like he dies in the middle of it, and then someone else comes in to take over, and then it just turns out to be just completely bad. But even then, I don't think that's as high of a possibility as we think it is, because I feel like for this next
project, speaking of getting into the weeds,
speaking of that, yeah, but I feel like they're gonna have a game plan in case he does croak.
There you go, Spencer.
I feel the worst thing that could possibly happen is the thing that happened to Satoshi Kon.
Tell me. I don't know this.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, so baby. Satoshi Kon, he's also like a guy who makes like animated movies.
Yeah. Are you aware of who Satoshi Kon is?
No.
So Satoshi Kon, why don't you, do you have any of the filmography that he's done?
Tokyo Godfathers.
I heard of that, yes.
Paprika. That one's, his movies are just odd but great.
He's a legend.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah.
He also did Paranoia Agent, which is just an insane anime.
Yeah.
So
Perfect Blue.
Yeah. Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress. So, the thing was, he was doing another one called Dreaming Machine, and I think it's barely gotten off the ground, and like he died, and like it was just such a weird movie that like no one could finish it because there was not enough left there to finish because he had barely started. And I kind of feel like that would be like, because like even if he like got halfway through, you could just put something in front and be like, he didn't finish this movie, we're gonna just put in storyboards and voice acting over the parts that he didn't do. But yeah, just not having enough to even do anything and just being left with what if, that's hard.
At that point, just cancel it, like straight up.
Well, wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether the film passes or fails as a film, as a story, and how many monocles out of 5. I'm going to go ahead and start with Amy.
If you thought this film didn't pass, you're wrong. It does. And with regards to everything that Miyazaki has continued to give for literally, as I said, 5 decades, 50 years of animation, this is a wonderful feather in his cap. Albeit it is not my absolute favorite, I could sit and ruminate on this all day. I will own it and I will see it again. Yeah. So I'm kind of left speechless with anything else to say, and I'm going to give it a 4.8 out of 5 monocles.
4.8. Spencer.
This movie passes for me. It's, as we've said many times, it's just so many layers. You could spend hours talking about this movie. Just so many ways to look at it, and you're going to have to watch it multiple times to really just like even get all the possible like perspectives on this movie.
Yeah.
Great music, great animation, just great watch. So for me, it's going to be 5 out of 5.
Hey. Mm-hmm.
Joey.
It fails as a movie. 0 out of 5.
After all that we said.
Divisive.
Yeah. No, it's an easy 5 for me too. Like it's interesting because like I'm coming into this not really knowledgeable of his movies. Like I know he's an icon and I love and respect him for that. All he's been able to achieve as an artist over like longer than my parents have been alive, probably. just knowing that this was sort of his, it is a swan song. It's probably not going to be the swan song for him, but it's definitely like his way of saying like, this is me leaving my mark on this world.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that I've been thinking about it for like every single day since I've seen it, like I've seen it fairly recently compared to all of you, but it also just might be my favorite movie of 2023 straight up. Yeah. This movie hits me in ways that no other movie has, period. And yeah, it's going to go down in my history as like one of my absolute favorite films.
And I think not to add to yours, like if I know what you're thinking, but also mm-hmm. I would say also in the stage of life where you're in right now and yeah. this film literally falling in the place where it is in the grand scheme of you, I think that also adds to that impact.
100%. Absolutely.
Well, and I also can't wait to talk to you once you see all the other ones, because then you're going to like, there's so much in his filmography that I want to find out exactly like how you feel about this one and how you feel about that one. And the only reason it's not a 5 for me is because Howl's Moving Castle is my flippin' favorite.
I was wondering what that point two.
That point two is like right there.
Yes.
It's the Christian Bale American accent. It's,
yeah, him yelling go away at people in the Batman voice.
We may have to do a wrap up of Studio Ghibli films with Joey when he's done. So
yeah.
But as for me, the film passes. Obviously, this is a beautiful story. This is a perfect eulogy for a man who has created stories galore for not only the silver screen but the small screen, for all aspects of life and in self. He has created a medium to which he can continuously impart on the world how he sees it and how he hopes that it'll be left after he's gone. So this film passes for me. In terms of monocles, I got to give it a 5. I think this is an absolute gem of a film. This is not only the feather in his cap, this is the jewel of his crown, the prime jewel for him to say what he said in this movie, and for him to be able to just honestly be real about where he's at in life and knowing that he wants to impart this not only on his children but the rest of the world that is out there. I have to say that this is a beautiful way to do it, and I really don't think that there has been any other beautiful kind of animation film that has come out in the last couple of years that could amount to what we've gotten out of this film, bar none. So this movie gets a 5 out of 5 for me, and I am happy with it. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Again, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to filmlosophers.com. Also, you can check us out on the socials over at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. We're also on Blue Sky at filmlosopherspodcast.social. So if you're looking for us there, find us there. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Listen in, let us know what you think. Give us a shout out if you're listening to us from wherever you are. We'd love to know where you're listening from in the comment section down below. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, indeed.
That's right. Joey, this was great having you on, man. I am so stoked that we're going to be able to do more of this in 2024, especially since we know that you got a little bit of homework with the Ghibli films in this. So we're excited, and thank you again for coming on. Where can people find you at and what you got going on?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at FerrisWheelPro, and you can find all my works at Game Explain. I would say GameExplain.com, but really it's YouTube.com/GameExplain. So yeah, check it out there if you like Nintendo and all things gaming.
And I know here in the local area, you just did a guest of honor thing with the SAC Gamers Expo. Do you have anything coming up in the current quarter or anything that you want to talk about or let people know about?
Not really. I got an exciting review coming out soon for a game I can't talk about, so stay tuned for that.
There you go. Yes. Secrets galore. So, well, again, thanks for coming on, man. And, of course, this was great to talk about this movie as well. So, but, yeah, that wraps up another episode. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Amy.
I'm Joey.
Class dismissed.